What does it truly take for a company to completely reinvent itself? You know, to shed decades of history, embrace an entirely new identity, and really embark on a fundamentally different path. In today's, well, let's face it, overwhelming information landscape, cutting through all the noise to grasp what's really happening can be tough. But that's precisely why we're here. Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we're embarking on a deep dive into Verus Residential Inc. that's listed on the New York Stock Exchange, ticker VRE. And this isn't just another real estate investment trust or REIT. It's a company that has undergone a really dramatic multi-year transformation, shifting from, well, a very diversified entity to a laser-focused player.
Yeah, and what's truly fascinating here, I think, is the sheer scale of the change and the compelling prove-it story that now defines Verus Residential. They genuinely sit at a critical inflection point. It's quite interesting. On one side, you have this remarkable operational momentum, I mean, showing really strong performance across key metrics. Yet on the other side, the public market valuation seems, well, conspicuously disconnected from the underlying intrinsic value of its assets. That disconnect, that central puzzle, is really what we aim to unravel for you today. It's not merely a new name on the door. It's a completely rebuilt identity.
Right. So, to crack this puzzle, we've meticulously pulled together an exhaustive set of sources. We've got a comprehensive investment analysis report, the company's own official filings, like their 10-K, you know, the big annual report, and also their most recent earnings presentations. Our mission, as always, is to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight from all this material, basically ensuring you walk away truly well-informed about Verus Residential and its, well, unique position in the market. Part one, the Phoenix from the ashes from a Cali to Verus Residential. Okay, so to understand Verus Residential today, we absolutely have to start with its past, right?
Absolutely.
For decades, its former self, McCallie Realty Corporation, was practically the opposite of what Verus is now. Formed way back in 1997 through a major merger, McCallie was this massive, diversified REIT, heavily concentrated on suburban and waterfront office properties, mainly here in the U.S. Northeast. Many companies tried to pivot, sure, but few manage an overhaul on this scale. You might even recall McCallie from its office building days. It was a pretty significant regional player.
Oh, definitely. A very well-known name in the office space for a long time.
But in recent years, this legacy portfolio started facing some severe secular headwinds. The whole nature of office work was shifting, you know, and the company's performance lagged. And that inevitably drew the keen eye of activist investors.
Yeah, that underperformance wasn't just a small concern. It was really a powerful catalyst for this profound change we're talking about. And this transformation wasn't like a sudden event overnight. It was a deliberate multi-year journey. It actually began way back in 2015, believe it or not. And then it truly accelerated significantly after a crucial board reconstitution in 2020. That was a key moment.
Okay.
And this kicked off what they called a systematic disposition program of its non-core assets, specifically its vast office portfolio. I mean, just consider the sheer scale of this divestiture. The company strategically sold more than 30 suburban office buildings.
Wow, 30.
Yeah, collectively generating over $1 billion in proceeds.
$1 billion.
Over a billion. And they also divested major waterfront office assets, including prominent properties like Harborside Plaza 1, 2, and 3 in Jersey City. Very well-known assets.
Right, I know those.
And these sales weren't just about, you know, tweaking the balance sheet a little. The proceeds were explicitly earmarked to simplify the business model, pay down a lot of debt, and critically transition to a pure-play multifamily strategy. That was the
Okay.
goal. This whole strategic pivot culminated just recently, actually, in 2024, with the sale of its final office property.
The very last one.
The last one. That's it. It definitively marked the completion of its transition into a pure-play multifamily REIT. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this was far more than just selling off assets. You know, it was a fundamental shift in investment philosophy and operational focus. It's like shedding an old skin completely to become something fundamentally new, a real metamorphosis.
Yeah, a true transformation. And to really cement that, in December 2021, the company formally rebranded. McCallie was out. Verus Residential Inc. was in. And this wasn't just, like you said, a simple name change on paper. It felt like a very conscious, strategic move to signify a complete break from the past, right? Establishing this new corporate identity focused only on residential properties, with a heavy emphasis, they say, on sustainability and delivering a superior resident experience. And today, Verus Residential operates as a fully integrated, self-administered, self-managed REIT, running its business through its operating partnership.
Essentially,
management.
Exactly. But despite the operational pivot being essentially complete, there's still what the market often calls a credibility discount. Investor perception, you know, it can lag behind the reality of such a significant long-term transformation. The market isn't going to immediately just re-rate the stock purely based on the new name or finishing the sales. It needs to see a sustained period of clean, predictable results from this new pure-play multifamily model.
Right. Show me the money, basically.
Exactly. Show me the consistent performance. And the strong recent performance we'll definitely talk about is certainly the foundational first step in building that new track record. But the core investment thesis for Veris now really hinges on management's consistent ability to deliver on its promises, especially around deleveraging. That was a key financial concern for the legacy company, for McCallie.
Absolutely.
So this raises an important question, I think. How long does it truly take for market perception to catch up with a fundamental business transformation like this? And, you know, what specific milestones does Veris need to hit to bridge that gap in the eyes of the broader investment community?
That's a critical point, because this strong recent performance, it really does feel like that foundational first step, building that new track record. And the investment thesis we're examining today, it seems heavily reliant on management's consistent ability to deliver on those promises, especially that deleveraging, which was, yeah, such a major overhang for the company in its former life. It feels like an ongoing process of earning trust back.
Precisely. It takes time.
Part two, the new Veris portfolio and management deep dive. So with this dramatic transformation largely behind them, let's turn our attention to the present. What does this all mean for the properties they actually own now? What does the new Veris portfolio truly look like?
Okay, so the new Veris residential portfolio is really defined by two key characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
Exceptional quality and an incredibly sharp geographic focus.
Yeah.
All of their assets are purposefully concentrated right here in the U.S. Northeast.
Okay.
To get more specific, they have a substantial presence in New Jersey, particularly in prime areas like Jersey City, Port Imperial, Weehawken, right across the river from Manhattan. They also maintain a notable footprint in Massachusetts, specifically in desirable suburbs of Boston, like Malden and Worcester. And they even have a property up in Tuckahoe, New York.
Mm-hmm.
But what's particularly insightful here, I think, is that this isn't just, you know, a broad regional focus. It's a high conviction bet on a very specific submarket.
Ah, interesting.
The portfolio is heavily weighted towards what's known as the New Jersey Gold Coast, those affluent communities nestled right along the Hudson River, offering direct views and, crucially, easy access to Manhattan.
Right.
According to the company's own filings, this single New Jersey waterfront market accounts for a commanding 72.2%.
Wow, over 70%.
72.2% of their consolidated multifamily portfolio's annualized contractual base rent. So a huge concentration.
That's a big bet.
It's a very big bet.
Yeah.
And this concentration benefits immensely from its proximity to New York City's high-wage job market, right? While at the same time offering a significant affordability advantage compared to living directly in Manhattan, which, as you can imagine, draws in a financially robust tenant base.
Okay, so quality and very specific geography. What about the actual buildings themselves?
Yeah, in terms of property composition and quality, as of year-end 2024, Veris's portfolio consisted of 22 multifamily properties. That encompasses 7,681 apartment units, including both consolidated and unconsolidated holdings, plus a few ancillary retail and parking assets tied to those properties. Their explicit strategy is an exclusive focus on premier Class A communities.
So top tier.
Top tier. These properties are designed from the ground up to attract affluent, long-term renters. And what truly stands out, and this represents a key competitive advantage for them, is the remarkable youth of their portfolio. The average asset age is only about 9 to 10 years old.
That's very young for a REIT portfolio.
It's incredibly young, which means these are modern, state-of-the-art properties. And practically speaking, they generally require significantly lower near-term maintenance capital expenditures compared to REITs with older, more mature portfolios. And that directly translates to better cash flow, right? Less money going out for upkeep.
Makes sense. Less fixing needed.
Exactly. And these aren't just new buildings. They are replete with premium amenities, really catering to a high-end tenant base. We're talking state-of-the-art fitness centers, luxurious rooftop pools with, you know, panoramic views, inviting resident lounges designed for community and collaboration, and even forward-thinking sustainability features like EV charging stations and expansive green roofs, things that really appeal today.
Yeah, definitely table stakes for Class A now.
Pretty much. And this high-end offering naturally attracts a financially resilient tenant base. Just to give you a striking detail that really underscores their tenant quality, As of the second quarter of 2025, the average household income per unit in their portfolio was an exceptionally high $445,334.
$445,000 average household income.
Average. Per unit. And, maybe even more astonishingly, residents are spending a very manageable 10.6% of that income on rent.
Wow, only 10.6% rent to income. That's incredibly low.
It's incredibly low. It indicates a substantial financial cushion and remarkable stability within their tenant base, suggests very low default risk and, likely, high retention potential. These tenants aren't stretched thin.
Yeah, imagine renting a luxury apartment and only spending about 10% of your income on it. That speaks volumes about the financial health of Veris' tenants. Okay, so behind this impressive portfolio, there's obviously a leadership team driving the ship. Who exactly are they, and what's their strategic compass looking like for the next few years?
Right. It signifies that their residents are definitely not rent burdened, as the term goes. They have significant discretionary income, which translates to a much more stable and desirable tenant base. And you're spot on. The successful execution of this transformation has indeed been spearheaded by a refreshed management team and board. The current CEO is Mahbod Nia. He was appointed in March 2021, though he joined the board a bit earlier, back in June 2020 during that activist push. And his prior experience is incredibly relevant here. It provides a credible blueprint for what Veris is aiming to achieve.
How so?
Well, as the former CEO of North Star Realty Europe Corp, or NRE, he led a very similar strategic pivot there, simplifying the business, reducing leverage significantly, and ultimately executing a highly successful sale of that company, which generated substantial shareholder returns. So he's done this before.
Okay, that's a very strong track record for this exact situation.
Exactly. And the senior leadership team also includes other seasoned executives like CFO Amanda Lombard and COO Anna Mahari, both bringing extensive public REIT and broader real estate experience to the table. And management's strategic vision for Veris is remarkably clear, it's concise, and it's focused on three core pillars that seem to guide all their decisions.
Okay, what are they?
First is capital allocation, which basically means crystallizing value by selling non-cash flowing or non-strategic assets, primarily the company's remaining land bank right now. The second pillar is balance sheet optimization. So they plan to use all those disposition proceeds to aggressively pay down debt, aiming to reduce their leverage to be more in line with their industry peers. That's crucial.
Right, hitting those peer levels.
Exactly. And the third pillar is platform optimization, which is all about driving superior operational performance through continuous technological innovation, centralizing functions for greater efficiency, and maintaining a hyper-focus on the resident experience. And this vision is actively supported by a board that was, as I mentioned, significantly reconstituted back in 2020 to oversee this pivot. And it was recently strengthened even further, just in July 2025, with the appointment of Christopher Papa. He's a veteran executive with direct, invaluable experience as a public multifamily REIT CFO. So very relevant expertise added.
Okay, strong team, clear plan. Now, something that genuinely stands out in their current strategy, you mentioned it briefly, is their commitment to ESG, environmental, social, and governance principles. How deeply integrated is that into their business model? Is it truly a core differentiator, or is it maybe more of a, you know, a marketing angle?
That's a great question, because it's absolutely presented as a defining characteristic of the new Veris, not just some external facade. Their Embrace by Veris residential program, that's what they call it, is positioned as a fundamental part of their brand identity, not merely an add-on initiative.
Okay.
And this commitment has yielded tangible, measurable results that go far beyond just buzzwords. They've received a prestigious 5-star rating from GRESB, that's a major global ESG benchmark for real estate, specifically for their ESG leadership. They've also achieved a remarkable 58% reduction in Scope 1 and 2 emissions since 2019, demonstrating a clear commitment to environmental stewardship.
That's a significant reduction.
It is. And perhaps most impressively, they became the first company globally to achieve the WELL equity rating across their entire portfolio, which focuses on health and well-being for residents and employees. So this doesn't feel like just greenwashing. It seems like a shrewd strategic differentiator. It's explicitly aimed at attracting both the growing segment of sustainability-conscious residents, who increasingly make housing choices based on these factors, and also a growing class of institutional investors who now explicitly prioritize ESG factors in their investment decisions.
Right. The big money is looking at ESG more and more.
Exactly. So it's a very smart move in today's market to appeal to those increasingly influential groups. It's good business, basically.
Part 3, market landscape and competitive dynamics. Okay, so with Veers' new identity firmly established, let's step back now and consider the broader currents. What's the overall multifamily market looking like right now, and how do Veers' specific geographic bets play into that larger picture?
Right, so nationally, the multifamily market is currently in a period of, let's call it, stabilization, especially after a historic wave of new supply that really peaked in 2024.
We saw a lot of cranes everywhere.
A lot of cranes. And while this supply surge has somewhat muted overall rent growth across the country, I mean, average U.S. rents were up just a slim 0.19% in June 2025, pretty flat. Demand has actually remained remarkably resilient. In the second quarter of 2025 alone, the market absorbed over 227,000 units, which has largely allowed occupancy to hold firm despite all that new supply hitting the market.
Okay, so demand is still there.
Demand is holding up. And looking forward, a significant supply cliff is widely anticipated for 2026 and beyond.
A supply cliff, what does that mean?
It means a sharp drop-off in new deliveries. Why? Because persistently high interest rates and elevated construction costs have caused new multifamily construction starts to just plummet.
Okay. It's too expensive to build right now.
Exactly. So this means we should see a much tighter supply-demand balance in the coming years, which in turn should naturally create upward pressure on rents again.
Yeah.
Basic economics.
Right. Less new stuff, rents go up.
Precisely. But here's where the Northeast dynamics, where Veris is concentrated, really come into stark contrast with those national trends. Veris's core markets exhibit exceptionally strong fundamentals, unlike, say, some of the supply-heavy Sunbelt markets we've heard about.
Okay. Different story locally.
Totally different story.
Okay.
Let's take northern New Jersey, which, as we said, represents the bulk of Veris's portfolio. This market is being described in some analyses as the hottest rental market in the Northeast.
The hottest? Wow.
Yeah. Demand is simply overwhelming. There are an estimated 14 prospective renters for every single vacant apartment.
14 to 1. That's incredible demand.
Incredible. And this isn't random. It's profoundly driven by the region's significant affordability advantage over New York City. It attracts a steady stream of young professionals, families, who want proximity to the high-wage job market, but without paying Manhattan prices.
The classic calculus.
Exactly. And the numbers back this up. Their lease renewal rate of 70.5% is well above the national average, which clearly indicates high resident satisfaction and retention. People want to stay.
Okay, so North Jersey is booming. What about Boston?
Boston, another key Veris market, also demonstrates robust health. In the second quarter of 2025, the vacancy rate there stood at 6.1%, which is comfortably below the national average of 8.2%.
Yeah.
So tighter than average. Even more importantly, year-over-year rent growth was a healthy 2.1%, significantly outpacing that flat national trend we just discussed.
Still growing rents there.
Still growing.
Yeah.
And crucially, the construction pipeline in Boston is currently at its lowest level in years, suggesting that competitive pressures from new supply will remain minimal in the near future. Mm. So this confluence of factors creates a really powerful dynamic for Veris. You've got this return to city adjacent trend in a post-pandemic hybrid work world, right, where Veris's New Jersey Gold Coast assets offer that compelling value proposition. More space, more affordability, but still direct access to Manhattan.
Best of both worlds, maybe.
Kind of. Simultaneously, extreme homeownership unaffordability in both the NYC and Boston metro areas creates this large, captive, and highly durable renter base. It's just too expensive to buy for many.
Right. Forces people to rent for longer.
Exactly. And critically, Veris operates in these high barrier to entry markets that are facing a supply drought, unlike many Sunbelt markets currently contending with a supply glut.
Ah.
This gives them a distinct advantage, we think, for superior growth in the coming years compared to maybe some other regions.
Okay, that market backdrop sounds very favorable for their specific locations. Now, interest rates have been such a hot topic for everyone lately, mortgages, savings accounts, everything. How do they factor into a REIT like Veris? What kind of impact do they have on their business, especially given their specific positioning and maybe their debt levels?
Yeah, it's a really nuanced and complex relationship, isn't it? On one hand, higher interest rates undeniably increase a company's cost of capital, makes borrowing more expensive, and they can certainly pressure valuations by making alternatives like bonds seem relatively more attractive. Yep. However, higher rates are often a product of a strong, growing economy, which in turn fuels job growth, wage gains, and robust demand for rental housing, all direct positives for a multifamily REIT like Veris.
Right, a bit of a double-edged sword.
Exactly. And Veris, in particular, seems to have proactively managed this risk quite well. As of mid-2025, 100% of its debt portfolio is either fixed rate or has been prudently hedged against interest rate movements.
100%.
100% fixed or hedged, using instruments like interest rate caps.
Okay, that's significant protection.
It's critical. It insulates their earnings, their FFO, from the immediate impact of rising rates, at least for the term of those hedges or fixed rate loans. Furthermore, higher rates have that chilling effect on the broader real estate transaction market, right?
Uh-huh.
Making it more difficult and expensive to finance new developments, which directly contributes to that forecast of declining new supply, that supply cliff we just discussed. So in a slightly odd way, rising rates can actually be a long-term tailwind for existing, well-located portfolios like theirs by limiting future competition.
Interesting dynamic. Okay. Beyond the economy and interest rates, who are today's renters? And what do they really want in a living situation? Are there broader, maybe less obvious demographic tailwinds that are working in Verus's favor?
Oh, absolutely. Verus Residential is strongly supported by some powerful long-term demographic trends that are really reshaping the housing market. The core of rental demand in the U.S. is now driven primarily by millennials and Generation Z. In fact, adults under the age of 35 now constitute over half of the entire rental population.
Over half?
Over half, with Gen Z alone accounting for more than 30% of renters. And these younger generations, you know, they consistently prioritize flexibility, convenience, and an amenity-rich, often social lifestyle.
Mm.
All of these preferences align perfectly with Verus's Class A product offering, which is really designed with these exact desires in mind.
Tailor-made, almost.
Pretty much. Furthermore, there's a significant structural shift happening in life milestones that's expanding the renter pool. The average age of a first-time homebuyer in the U.S. has risen to 38.
38? Wow, I thought it was lower.
It used to be 31 not that long ago, so that's a significant increase.
Yeah.
This delay in homeownership essentially extends the average renting life cycle by about 7 years, creating a larger and more durable base of demand for apartment owners like Verus. And this trend is amplified even further in Verus's high-cost coastal markets like New York and Boston metro areas, where the financial hurdles to homeownership are particularly high, making renting a long-term necessity for a larger portion of the population. It creates sort of captive market for high-quality rental properties.
Right. They just can't afford to buy, so they rent these nice places instead.
For longer periods, yes.
Okay. It sounds like a lot of powerful tailwinds for Verus, which is, you know, promising. But as we always emphasize, no investment comes without risks. What about regulatory challenges, specifically something like rent control, which can be a significant and often unpredictable concern for real estate investors, especially in the Northeast?
You're absolutely right to highlight that. Regulatory risk, particularly rent control, is a primary and persistent factor for landlords in the Northeast, where Verus operates. It's always lurking.
Mm-hmm.
In New Jersey, for instance, there isn't a blanket statewide rent control law. However, it operates under a system of home rule, which means individual municipalities can enact their own ordinances, and over 100 towns and cities have done so.
Over 100, wow. Patchwork quilt of rules?
It's a real patchwork. And in Verus's key markets, these laws are a material consideration. Jersey City, for example, limits annual rent increases to 4%, or the Consumer Price Index, whichever is lower. Newark has a similar CPI-based cap of 4%. These regulations can directly limit a landlord's ability to capture full market rent growth, especially during periods of high inflation or strong demand. It effectively caps potential net operating income growth.
Puts a ceiling on things.
It definitely puts a ceiling on upside in those specific locations. And then in Massachusetts, as of 2025, there is no statewide rent control currently. However, it is a persistent political issue there. It keeps coming up on the legislative agenda.
Always being debated.
Always being debated. New legislation has been proposed that would grant local governments the authority to adopt their own rent stabilization measures, potentially capping annual increases at the rate of inflation up to a maximum of 5%. Now, while this specific legislation hasn't passed yet, its potential enactment represents the most significant regulatory risk, I'd say, to Verus's Massachusetts portfolio and the broader market there. Mm. The strong rent growth currently being achieved in these markets could, ironically, provide political momentum for such measures, creating potential future headwinds.
Right. Success breeds regulatory attention sometimes.
It can, unfortunately.
Okay. So given these market dynamics and these potential risks, how does Verus Residential stack up against its peers, especially the much larger players in the multifamily REIT space? Is it kind of punching above its weight operationally, or is it smaller scale a real disadvantage when you compare them head to head?
Yeah, that's the core comparison. Verus operates in a highly competitive landscape dominated by these larger, well-capitalized, publicly traded multifamily REITs. For comparison, we typically look at companies with significant exposure to high-cost coastal markets, particularly the Northeast. So names like AvalonBay Communities, AVB, Equity Residential, EQR, UDR Inc., UDR, and maybe Camden Property Trust. The big guys, exactly. And a comparative analysis immediately reveals Verisk's distinct profile. It is significantly smaller and much more geographically concentrated than its peers. That's the first thing you notice. For context, giants like AvalonBay and Equity Residential manage portfolios of roughly 95,000 and 85,000 apartment units, respectively, spread across multiple major U.S. markets.
Huge scale.
Verisk's same-store portfolio, in contrast, is around 7,500 units, heavily weighted, as we said, to essentially a single metropolitan area. This lack of scale and diversification is, frankly, a key competitive disadvantage. Larger peers often benefit from greater operational leverage, broader economic exposure, and typically a lower cost of capital, which impacts everything from financing new deals to advertising budgets.
Right. Scale has its benefits.
It does. However, on recent operational performance, Verisk is demonstrating clear leadership. This is where their story gets interesting. In the second quarter of 2025, Verisk reported robust blended rent growth of 4.7% and impressive same-store net operating income, or NOI, growth of 5.6%.
That sounds strong. How does it compare?
It appears to significantly outpace its larger peers based on their first quarter 2025 results. For example, AvalonBay and Equity Residential reported same-store revenue growth, slightly different metric, but directionally useful of 3.0% and 2.2%, respectively. So Verisk's NOI growth was quite a bit stronger.
Okay, outperforming recently then.
It seems so. And management's own 2025 core FFO, funds from operations, growth guidance of 5.0% to 6.7% is explicitly positioned as leading the multifamily peer group. And Verisk's operating margin, which improved to 67.4% year-to-date, also appears strong on a relative basis, reflecting successful cost control measures that we can dive into later. So yes, while smaller, they are certainly performing very well operationally right now.
That's a compelling point about their operational outperformance. But even with its smaller size and more concentrated portfolio, does Verisk possess particular advantages that allow it to compete effectively against these much larger, more diversified players? What's their unique edge, if they have one?
Yes, absolutely. I think they do. Despite its relatively smaller scale, Verisk Residential possesses several key competitive advantages that protect its business model and differentiate it. First, as we touched on, there are high barriers to entry in its core market.
Right, hard to build there.
Extremely hard. Their strategic concentration in the New Jersey Gold Coast and those Boston suburbs provides a significant competitive moat. These are infill locations with difficult, lengthy, and expensive entitlement and permitting processes. Plus, there's just a scarcity of available land for new development. This structural limitation on new supply protects incumbent landlords like Verisk from excessive competition and strongly supports long-term pricing power. It's hard for others to come in.
Makes sense. What else?
Second is superior asset quality. We mentioned the average property age is only around a decade. That makes Verisk's portfolio genuinely one of the most modern in the public REIT space. Newer assets are inherently more attractive to today's renters, they command premium rents, and importantly require significantly less near-term capital investment for maintenance and upgrades compared to older properties, which again translates directly into higher free cash flow generation.
Better margins, potentially.
Potentially, yes. And third, they seem to have cultivated a best-in-class brand and operating platform. This is powerfully evidenced by their hashtag #1 ranking among all public and private multifamily companies in the J. Turner Research Online Reputation Assessment, or ORA. That's a big deal.
Number one overall, not just among REITs.
Number one overall, ahead of peers like AvalonBay and Camden. It's a testament to exceptionally high resident satisfaction. And this isn't just about, you know, getting good reviews online, although that's part of it. It signals a highly efficient, tech-driven operation that likely impacts their bottom line.
How so?
Well, a strong reputation can translate directly into lower marketing costs, higher resident retention, which is huge for avoiding turnover costs, and potentially greater pricing power. And this is very likely driven by the company's vertically integrated platform and its PRISM technology initiative, which focuses on enhancing the resident experience and driving operational efficiencies through data.
So it's not just good reviews. It's about a highly efficient, tech-driven operation that directly impacts their bottom line and, you know, your potential returns as an investor.
Exactly. It's operational excellence translating into financial results.
Okay, that's a great overview of their competitive stance. Now, to truly put some numbers on this, our sources provide a peer comparison matrix. gives us a snapshot of Varis against its competitors. What does this quantitative comparison tell us about their position in the market? Does it confirm what you've been saying?
Yes, I think this matrix perfectly illustrates the paradox we highlighted right at the beginning. You see the strong operational performance and asset quality, but you also see a valuation and critically a balance sheet profile that looks fundamentally different from its larger or more mature peers. It really encapsulates the core of the Pruvit story.
Okay, walk us through some key metrics from that matrix.
Sure. You immediately see market capitalization and total units just emphasize Varis's significantly smaller scale. We're talking a $1.4 billion market cap and around 7,700 units are Varis versus, say, Avalon Bay at $28.7 billion and 95,000 units. It's a different league in terms of size.
Night and day.
Completely. Mm-hmm. In terms of same-store occupancy, Varis was at 93.9% in Q2 2025. Now, while this is slightly lower than some peers like Avalon Bay, which was at 96.0% in Q1 2025, it's important context, as we mentioned earlier, that Varis's figure is temporarily impacted by an ongoing major renovation at their large Liberty Towers property.
Ah, right, the renovation drag.
Exactly. Excluding that specific renovation impact, their occupancy is actually a very robust 95.5%, so fundamentally strong.
Okay.
Now, for the good news again, same-store NOI growth. Mm. Varis is clearly leading here, reporting that strong 5.6% in Q2 2025. Mm. This compares very favorably to peers in Q1 2025, like Avalon Bay at 2.6% NOI growth and Equity Residential at 1.3% NOI growth. So this is where their operational excellence truly shines through in the numbers. They're managing their current portfolio very effectively.
Clear outperformance there, but what about the balance sheet side?
Right. Here's where the matrix highlights their primary challenge. Net debt to EBITDA. Varis is at an elevated 11.3x as of Q2 2025.
11.3 times.
Yes, which is significantly higher than peers who are typically in the 4x to 6x range. You mentioned Avalon Bay at 4.3x. So Varis is roughly double the leverage of some key peers. This is a critical point that demands attention from any investor.
Yeah, that really stands out. How does that affect valuation?
Well, this elevated debt level also impacts their price-to-core FFO multiple for 2025 estimates. Varis trades at a higher multiple, around 22.7x, compared to the peer average of around 17.0x. And this is largely because their FFO, the denominator in that ratio, is temporarily depressed by that high interest expense due to their elevated leverage. It makes the FFO multiple look less attractive on the surface.
So the debt makes the earnings multiple look high.
Exactly. Finally, their dividend yield is lower, around 2.2%, compared to the peer average of around 3.7%. This isn't necessarily a negative sign, though. It reflects a more conservative payout ratio as they prioritize deleveraging and strengthening the balance sheet. They're keeping cash to pay down debt.
Okay.
So, yes, this matrix perfectly illustrates that paradox.
Mm-hmm.
Strong operations, great assets, but a balance sheet and resulting valuation metrics that look quite different from the big established players.
Part four, financial and operational performance. The numbers tell the story. That's a very clear picture of their relative position. Now let's dig into the actual numbers themselves a bit more. How has this impressive transformation truly played out on their financial statements over the past few years? What do those trends reveal about their new strategy in action?
Yeah, looking at Varis Residential's financial performance over the past 5 years really illustrates the profound impact of its strategic transformation. It's quite stark. Initially, if you look back, total revenues actually declined. Which makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. They were aggressively selling off those assets from the McGalley days.
Selling revenue-generating assets.
Exactly. That's a natural consequence of selling off a large, non-core part of your business. However, the underlying story here is one of significant portfolio quality enhancement. That's the key takeaway. As those lower-margin office assets were sold, they were replaced by the net operating income from a growing portfolio of stabilized, high-end multifamily properties. And this shift is clearly evident in their same-store NOI growth reported in recent periods. That metric isolates the performance of that core ongoing multifamily portfolio. For example, full year 2024 same-store NOI growth was a robust 7.9%.
Almost 8% growth from the core assets.
Yes, which is a clear and compelling indicator of the earning power of their new focused asset base.
Okay, what about FFO, funds from operations?
Right. Looking at FFO, which, as you know, is a crucial metric for REITs because it adjusts for non-cash depreciation, giving us a clearer picture of their operating cash flow and cash available for distributions, it also reflects this strategic transition. While asset sales can create some short-term dilution to FFO per share, naturally, the underlying operational strength of the multifamily portfolio has driven a strong recovery and growth. In 2024, the company grew its core FFO per share by a significant 13% year over year. They actually surpassed their original guidance.
13% growth in core FFO per share, that's strong.
Very strong. And this momentum has continued into 2025. The company recently raised its full-year core FFO guidance to a range of 63 cents to 64 cents per share, which represents a further 5.0% to 6.7% growth over 2024. So continued solid growth expected. And when we look at their same-store metrics, which provide the clearest view of the health of their core ongoing business, occupancy in the consolidated multifamily portfolio has been strong and stable. It ended 2024 at 93.7% after recovering from a dip back during the height of the pandemic uncertainty in 2020. And blended net rental growth, which combines new and renewal leases, was a very healthy 4.0% for the full year 2024. And then it accelerated even further to 4.7% in the second quarter of 2025, truly demonstrating significant pricing power in its core markets. They're able to push rents.
That's a clear picture of strong operational improvement, especially considering the large-scale asset sales happening simultaneously. Our five-year financial summary table from the sources further highlights these trends. Looking at the data for 2024, we see total revenue at $267.7 million, same-store NOI at $200.7 million, core FFO per share at $0.60, and dividends per share at 0.2625. These figures really underscore the strong performance of their transformed portfolio, especially when you consider that the higher total revenues back in 2020 and 2021 were still inflated by the legacy office portfolio they've now sold.
Exactly.
The meaningful increase in core FFO per share from 2022 to 2024, for example, really highlights the success of their pivot to multifamily. The numbers are bearing it out.
Absolutely. And this strong performance is underpinned by very disciplined portfolio activity. It's not happening by accident. The company's inorganic activity, buying and selling, has been almost entirely focused on dispositions, selling assets to fund its crucial deleveraging plan. In 2024 alone, Veris completed $223 million in non-strategic sales, and this pace has actually accelerated in 2025. They closed $268 million in sales year-to-date as of late July.
Picking up the pace.
Picking up the pace. And they have an additional $180 million in assets already under binding contract to be sold. These sales have primarily consisted of the company's remaining land parcels and select non-core multifamily assets, which clearly demonstrates a disciplined execution of their capital recycling strategy. Focus on the best assets, use the cash to reduce debt.
Clear strategy. What about buying? Any acquisitions?
Acquisition activity, in contrast, has been highly selective and very strategic, almost like a surgical approach, really. The most notable recent transaction was in April 2025. They acquired the remaining 15% interest in the Jersey City Irby high-rise, which they've now rebranded as Sable.
Okay, buying out a partner.
Exactly. They bought the remaining stake for $38.5 million. And this move is significant because it consolidates ownership of a premier asset right in their core market. It simplifies a joint venture structure, which is always good for efficiency. And it's expected to be immediately accretive to earnings. Plus, it allows Veris to realize operational synergies by bringing the management of that property entirely in-house. Just a very smart, targeted move for long-term efficiency.
Okay, makes sense. So with all these sales aimed squarely at deleveraging, what's their plan for growth moving forward? Are they building new properties from the ground up, or are they looking at other avenues for expansion now that they've largely shed the old portfolio and simplified things?
That's an excellent and really important question for understanding their current strategy and priorities. Veris Residential does possess a valuable but currently latent growth engine in its development pipeline. They still own a substantial land bank.
The land they haven't sold yet.
Exactly. Primarily located on that New Jersey waterfront and also Massachusetts, with the potential on paper to support the development of approximately 2,297 new apartment units. So significant future potential there.
Right.
However, and this is key under the current strategic plan, the primary goal is explicitly not to deploy capital into new construction right now.
Okay, so not building for now.
Not building for now. Instead, the focus is on monetizing this land, selling it off. The company's announced disposition pipeline of $300 to $500 million explicitly includes the sale of the majority of its land bank. They've been very clear about that.
Selling the potential, basically.
Selling the potential to raise cash now. And this is a very prudent capital light strategy, especially in the current environment of high interest rates and high construction costs. It de-risks the balance sheet significantly and allows management to focus squarely on its core priorities, deleveraging and optimizing the existing portfolio they already own. So while that land bank certainly provides significant long-term optionality for future growth down the road, near-term development is simply not a strategic priority for them today. The emphasis is clearly on discipline, balance sheet repair, not aggressive expansion.
Okay, discipline first. So if they're not building much new right now, where's the growth actually coming from in the short term? What's driving their impressive operational performance, that strong NOI growth, if it's not from new development adding units?
Right. For the foreseeable future, Veris's growth will be driven almost exclusively by organic means, stuff they do with the existing portfolio. The core of their strategy is centered on maximizing the performance of their existing high-quality portfolio. This includes driving rental revenue through strong leasing execution and capturing market rent growth, which we've already seen evidence of with that very strong 4.7% blended rent growth in Q2 2025.
Pushing rents on existing units.
Exactly. A second key pillar, and this is truly impressive, is rigorous expense control, which is significantly aided by the company's centralized operating platform and those technology initiatives like Prism we mentioned. I mean, get this. Total same-store property expenses actually decreased by 3.4% year-over-year in Q2 2025.
Decreased? Expenses went down. That's rare.
It's very rare, especially with inflation. They achieved a 3.7% reduction in controllable expenses, which is great management. But remarkably, they even achieved a 3.2% reduction in non-controllable expenses, things like property taxes, insurance, utilities. That's incredibly difficult to do.
How did they manage that?
It points to really effective management, maybe successful tax appeals, renegotiating contracts, energy efficiency gains from their ESG efforts, perhaps. It's really strong execution. And this is what we call operational alpha. It's finding ways to boost the bottom line beyond just rent increases.
Right.
It's a direct result, I think, of their superior tech-enabled operating platform, that centralized leasing function, and the Prism technology helping them manage efficiently. This allows them to generate strong net operating income growth, even when rents aren't skyrocketing everywhere, simply by being incredibly efficient. And it's reflected in their 200 basis point year-over-year improvement in operating margin to 67.5% in Q2. That's a significant jump in profitability.
Wow, okay. Operational efficiency is key. What else?
Finally, the company is pursuing targeted value-add redevelopment projects within the existing portfolio, like the approximately $30 million renovation at Liberty Towers in Jersey City. That's expected to generate a high 18% return on investment upon completion.
18% ROI, that's attractive.
Very attractive. And a smaller scale renovation of about $1.5 million is also planned for the Portside property in East Boston, with a projected 15% ROI. So these initiatives demonstrate a prudent strategy of deploying capital into high return projects that can organically grow the portfolio's cash flow stream without massive new development risk. Plus, their strong leasing velocity, with 4.0% new lease growth in Q2 2025 and high retention rates, with 5.2% renewal increases, also contribute significantly by reducing turnover costs and vacancy loss. It all adds up.
Okay.
So it's only once the balance sheet is successfully repaired and leverage is reduced to that target level of below 9.0x net debt to EBITDA that the company will likely have the financial flexibility to pivot back towards inorganic growth, whether that's restarting development on its remaining land parcels or pursuing strategic acquisitions. But that phase of the strategy is definitely a longer-term consideration. It's dependent on hitting those balance sheet targets first. Job one is deleveraging.
Part five, capital allocation and balance sheet strength. Okay, this brings us perfectly to what many, myself included, would argue is the most critical piece of the puzzle for Veris Residential, especially given its history. The balance sheet, how they're managing their debt. This was such a legacy concern from them at Cali days, and it clearly remains a key focus for investors today.
Indeed, it absolutely is. The company's balance sheet is, without doubt, the primary focus for management and a key concern, or perhaps opportunity, for investors. As of the end of the second quarter of 2025, the company's net debt stood at approximately $1.8 billion. And the critical leverage metric here, as we discuss with the peer comparison, is net debt to normalized EBITDA, which was 11.3x.
Still feels high.
It is significantly elevated when compared to the large cap multifamily peer group, where leverage ratios are typically in that much lower 5.2x to 6.0x range. Another important metric, the debt to equity ratio, also stood at 1.37, indicating a higher reliance on debt relative to equity. Recognizing this, management has made deleveraging its foremost strategic priority. They talk about it constantly. They've established clear and, I think, credible targets to reduce net debt to EBITDA to approximately 10.0x by the end of 2025.
So improvement by year end.
That's the goal. and then to get below 9.0x by the end of 2026.
Yeah.
And the path to achieving these targets is entirely through the disciplined execution of his ongoing asset disposition program. It's all directly tied to successfully selling those non-strategic assets. That's the engine for deleveraging.
Got it. Proceeds go straight to debt paydown.
Primarily, yes. Furthermore, the company's trailing 12-month or TTM interest coverage ratio is currently 1.7x.
1.7? That sounds low.
It is a relatively low figure. It signals that their current earnings cover their interest expenses with a fairly limited cushion, which clearly underscores, again, the immense importance of this deleveraging initiative to improve their financial flexibility and reduce risk. Understanding this leverage ratio is absolutely key for any potential investor looking at Verus. It's the most significant concern and simultaneously the biggest opportunity for this company to re-rate its value if they succeed.
Right. The biggest risk and the biggest potential reward tied together. Now, with that much debt, $1.8 billion, what does their repayment schedule look like? Are there any looming cliffs, any big chunks coming due soon that could create immediate refinancing risks, especially in this higher rate environment?
That's an excellent and crucial question. And it's actually a significant mitigating factor to the high leverage number itself. Verus Residential has no consolidated debt maturities until 2026.
Nothing until 2026. Okay, that's some breathing room.
It provides a clear runway for them to execute their strategic plan without immediate refinancing pressure breathing down their neck. The weighted average maturity of its debt was 2.6 years as of June 30, 2025, which gives them some valuable time. And crucially, and this is a key piece of prudent financial management we touched on earlier, as of mid-2025, 100% of the company's debt portfolio is either fixed rate or has been hedged with instruments like interest rate caps.
Still 100% protected.
Yes. This effectively insulates their funds from operations, from the immediate impact of rising interest rates in the short term.
Yeah.
It protects their earnings from that volatility. Very important piece of risk management.
Yeah, definitely. And we can also clearly visualize this runway if we look at their debt maturity schedule provided in the sources. It shows very modest principal maturities of just over $9 million in 2025. Practically nothing. Before maturities then step up quite a bit to nearly $476 million in 2026 and then over $662 million in 2027.
Mm-hmm.
So the laddered profile, with really nothing significant consolidated due until 2026, really does underscore the time they have to execute their deleveraging plan without that immediate pressure cooker.
Exactly. It's well managed from a maturity perspective. And despite its higher leverage profile, Verus has demonstrated continued access to the capital markets on favorable terms. It's just a strong signal of confidence from lenders, frankly.
They can still borrow.
Yes, and on good terms. In the second quarter of 2025, the company successfully secured an amendment to its revolving credit facility and its term loan agreement. And this amended facility introduced a leverage-based pricing grid, meaning as their leverage comes down, their interest rate automatically steps down too.
Ah, built-in incentive.
Exactly. And it resulted in an immediate and meaningful 55 basis point reduction in its corporate borrowing costs right off the bat.
Wow. Over 0.5% saved immediately.
Yes. And this isn't just, you know, a technical finance point. It signals strong confidence from a broad syndicate of lenders in management's strategic direction and its ability to execute the deleveraging plan. They believe they can do it. It also offers the potential for further interest savings as leverage targets are met over time, which will directly flow to the bottom line and improve their FFO. So it's a positive signal.
Okay, that's encouraging from the lenders. What about dividends? How are they handling shareholder payouts? Are they paying out to shareholders, or are they holding on to every penny of cash to prioritize that critical debt repayment, especially with that elevated leverage ratio?
Verus Residential currently pays a quarterly dividend of 0.08 per share, which equates to an annualized dividend of $0.32 per share. Based on a recent stock price around $14.50, this represents a dividend yield of roughly 2.2%.
2.2%, okay.
Now, it's worth noting that this dividend was actually increased by approximately 60% on an annualized basis during 2024.
A 60% hike,
yeah,
while deleveraging.
Yes, which reflected management's growing confidence in the stability and growth of the company's cash flows coming from that new, strong multifamily portfolio. It was a statement of confidence.
Okay. Is it sustainable?
Yes. The sustainability of this dividend looks strong right now. Based on the midpoint of the company's raised 2025 core FFO guidance of Firstown 635 per share, the $1.32 annualized dividend represents a very conservative payout ratio of approximately 50%.
Only paying out half their FFO.
Roughly half, which is a very healthy level for a REIT. It allows the company to comfortably cover its distribution while retaining significant cash flow for its primary objective, debt reduction. And this low payout ratio also provides substantial capacity for future dividend growth as the balance sheet strengthens and FFO expands down the line. So potential for future hikes is there.
Okay, so balancing debt paydown with some return to shareholders and potential future growth. Makes sense. So given these financial levers, the asset sales, the debt targets, the dividend policy, how exactly is management prioritizing where all this cash goes? What's their definitive capital allocation playbook right now?
Management has been exceptionally clear and very disciplined regarding its capital allocation priorities, which is crucial, I think, for building investor confidence, especially after the McCauley history. The overarching goal, they state, is to maximize long-term shareholder value by closing that significant gap between the company's stock price and its intrinsic net asset value, or NAV.
The NAV discount we talked about.
Exactly. The near-term strategy to achieve this is really twofold, and they're very clear about the order. First, deleveraging is the number one priority, period. The bulk of proceeds from the planned $300 to $500 million in asset sales will be used to repay debt, with the explicit goal of achieving that net debt-to-EBITDA ratio below 9.0x. This is fundamental to their financial health and their re-rating story.
Job one.
Second, though, in conjunction with that disposition plan, the company has announced a share repurchase program of up to $100 million.
Buying back their own stock.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is a direct and potentially very accretive way to take advantage of the significant discount at which the stock is currently trading relative to its NAV. If they truly believe it's undervalued, buying it back makes sense.
Right, using the discount to benefit remaining shareholders.
Precisely. So this plan seems logical and shareholder-friendly. It carefully balances the essential need for balance sheet health with opportunistic returns to shareholders at what management clearly believes is an attractive valuation. It's pretty much exactly what you'd want to see from a management team in this specific situation.
Part 6, valuation analysis and risk assessment. Okay, this leads us perfectly to the big question for any potential investor. How is Veris Residential actually valued in the market today? And what does that valuation tell us about the opportunity or maybe the risks it might present right now?
Yeah, the valuation of Veris Residential presents this really compelling dichotomy as we've been discussing. It's central to the whole investment thesis. On earnings-based multiples, like price to FFO, the company might appear, let's say, expensive relative to its peers. For instance, based on the midpoint of management's raised 2025 core FFO guidance, 0.635 per share, and a recent stock price around $14.50, Veris trades at a forward PFFO multiple of approximately 22.7x.
22.7, and peers are lower.
Yes, this multiple is indeed higher than the peer group average, which tends to trade more in the 16x to 18x range. However, as we discussed, this is largely a function of Veris' FFO per share being temporarily depressed by the high interest expense resulting from its elevated leverage. The denominator is artificially low right now.
Got it. The debt effect again.
Exactly. Now, where it gets really interesting and where the potential opportunity lies is when we look at net asset value, NAV. This is arguably the most critical valuation metric for Veris, given its asset-heavy nature as a real estate company. Management has repeatedly highlighted the dislocation that exists between the company's public market value and the underlying intrinsic value of its high-quality real estate portfolio. They keep pointing this out.
They think the market is wrong.
They clearly do.
Yeah.
And this sentiment is echoed by sell-side analysts. That research from JP Morgan we mentioned, for example, estimates that Veris trades at a substantial 28% discount to its NAV.
Almost a third off the estimated asset value.
A very significant discount. And the company's $100 million share repurchase program is an explicit strategy to capitalize on this very discount and create value for shareholders by buying back those perceived undervalued shares. Their dividend yield, as we mentioned, is around 2.2%, which is below the peer average. Again, a direct result of the company's conservative payout ratio and its strategic decision to prioritize retaining cash flow for debt reduction. And finally, just for another metric, if we look at enterprise value to EBITDA, using the Q2 2025 trailing 12-month adjusted EBITDA of $159.2 million and an enterprise value of roughly $3.12 billion, the EBITDA multiple comes out to approximately 19.6x.
Okay. But that NAV discount, that 28%, is really striking. What does that imply about how the market views their property specifically? Are investors just not seeing the value in those Class A buildings in prime locations, or is there something else at play that leads to such a big discrepancy?
Yeah, it's a great question. That 28% discount to NAV strongly suggests that the public market right now is assigning a high capitalization rate, or cap rate, to Veris's portfolio. The J.P. Morgan analysis estimates that the market is effectively valuing Veris's assets at an implied cap rate of approximately 6.0%.
6% cap rate. Is that high or low for these kinds of assets?
For these kinds of assets, it appears quite high. Think of a cap rate as the effective yield an investor would get if they bought the properties outright based on their current income. A higher cap rate means a lower valuation for the same amount of income. Given the Class A quality, the very young average age, and the prime locations of Veris's properties, especially in supply-constrained markets like northern New Jersey, where private market transaction cap rates for similar assets are demonstrably lower, maybe closer to 5% or even below.
Yeah.
This implied public market cap rate of 6% seems elevated. It suggests that if this portfolio were to be sold off piece by piece in the private market today, it would likely fetch a significantly higher total valuation than what is currently implied by the public stock price. So, yes, it implies the market isn't giving them full credit for the quality of the real estate they own, likely due to the overhang of the leverage and the execution needed on the deleveraging plan.
Right. The assets are great, but the company's structure or balance sheet is causing the discount.
That seems to be the market's current view, yes.
Okay. To quickly summarize these valuation points using our valuation summary table again, Veris's price to core FFO for 2025 estimates is around 22.7x, higher than the peer average of 17.0x, mainly due to that depressed FFO from debt. Their dividend yield is about 2.2%, below the peer average of 3.7%, reflecting the focus on debt paydown. But most strikingly, their price to NAV is estimated at 0.72x, implying that substantial 28% discount compared to peers who typically trade much closer to 1.00x NAV, or even at a premium sometimes. This clearly lays out the valuation discrepancy we're discussing. But, of course, no deep dive is complete without a thorough look at the potential pitfalls. What are the key risks an investor would need to seriously consider here?
Indeed. An investment in Veris Residential absolutely carries several material risks that must be carefully weighed against those potential opportunities. First, there's the geographic concentration risk we discussed.
Right, the heavy bet on North Jersey NYC Metro.
Exactly. With over 72% of its rental revenue coming from that single region, this lack of geographic diversification makes Veris highly susceptible to any localized economic downturns, adverse regulatory changes like rent control, or specific demand shifts unique to this area. A significant slowdown in the high-wage job sectors of New York City, for instance, could directly impact the financial health of Veris's very affluent tenant base more than a diversified REIT.
Makes sense. What's next?
Second, and this is still the primary financial risk, is the interest rate sensitivity and financial risk stemming from that elevated leverage. That net debt-to-EBITDA ratio of 11.3x is still well above peer averages and significantly amplifies financial risk. The low interest coverage ratio of 1.7x also provides a limited cushion to absorb potentially higher debt service costs in the future.
Even with the hedges.
Well, while near-term refinancing risk is mitigated by their well-laddered maturity schedule and the use of those hedges, a sustained higher-for-longer interest rate environment could make future refinancing, when those hedges roll off or debt matures in 2026 and beyond, significantly more costly. That could pressure profitability over the medium to long term if rates stay high.
Okay, a medium-term risk there.
Definitely. Then you have the regulatory and rent control risks we detailed earlier. Veris operates in jurisdictions with existing rent control ordinances in New Jersey that cap annual rent increases. And in Massachusetts, the ongoing political debate around enabling local rent control represents a significant potential headwind that could negatively impact the long-term growth profile of that portion of their portfolio if something passes.
A cap on their growth potential.
Potentially, yes. Fourth, while their core markets currently enjoy high barriers to entry and limited new supply, the competitive landscape and new supply dynamics could theoretically change over the long term. Any significant new development of luxury apartment communities in close proximity to Veris's assets, if someone does manage to navigate those high barriers, would introduce direct competition and could pressure occupancy and rental rates eventually. You can never rule out competition entirely.
True.
And finally, and this is really crucial right now, there's execution risk on dispositions. The company's entire deleveraging strategy, hitting those targets, is fundamentally predicated on its ability to successfully execute the sale of that $300 to $500 million in non-strategic assets at attractive prices. Management themselves have openly acknowledged that this is occurring in a challenging and deteriorating transaction market right now. It's harder to sell assets today than it was a couple of years ago.
Right. Higher rates make it harder for buyers, too.
Exactly. So Any failure to complete these sales in a timely manner or expected valuations would inevitably delay the deleveraging process, undermine management credibility, and negatively impact the entire investment thesis. It's a key risk to watch.
Part 7, investment thesis synthesis, tying it all together.
Okay, so we've gone on quite the journey here with Veris Residential. We've examined its dramatic transformation, its new portfolio, the market it operates in, its financials, its valuation, and importantly, its risks. Let's try to pull it all together now. What are the big takeaways, the key strengths, the potential catalysts that could drive future value? And what should we really continue to keep a close eye on as this prove its story unfolds? Yeah, let's synthesize. The investment case for Veris Residential is truly built on this foundation of a successfully completed business transformation, a high-quality underlying asset base, and a clear, albeit challenging, path forward towards value creation. Let's summarize the strengths first. What's going for them? First, the pure-play transformation is complete. Veris is now a focused, easier-to-understand Class A multifamily REIT. The complexity of the old Macaulay is gone.
Simpler story.
Second, they boast superior portfolio quality. These are young, modern, highly amenitized properties, strategically located in supply-constrained, high-barrier-to-entry markets. Plus, they benefit from those strong demographic tailwinds we discussed. Third, they've demonstrated operational excellence recently, delivering sector-leading growth in same-store NOI and blended rents, driven by that best-in-class, tech-enabled operating platform that is also proving remarkably effective at controlling expenses.
The operational alpha.
Exactly. Fourth, they have a clear deleveraging strategy. Management has articulated a credible and actionable plan to significantly strengthen the balance sheet through non-core asset sales. The path is clear. And finally, they have a strong liquidity profile for the near term. No consolidated debt maturities until 2026, and all their debt is fixed or hedged, insulating them from immediate refinancing and interest rate risk.
Okay, those are compelling strengths. What about the catalysts? What could actually make the stock price move or close that NAV gap? The aha moments.
Right, the potential catalysts. What could unlock value? The primary catalyst, I think, is closing the NAV gap. Successful execution of their asset sales, the subsequent debt repayment, and hitting those leverage reduction targets could simply force the market to re-rate the stock closer to its underlying net asset value.
Right.
And that $100 million share repurchase program directly accelerates this process by opportunistically buying back shares at that discount.
Management action driving the re-rating.
Potentially, yes. Second, continued operational outperformance is key. Sustained delivery of above peer average growth in NOI and FFO would further validate the new business model and management's capabilities, likely attracting a broader investor base over time. Keep putting up the numbers. Third, the stabilization of renovated assets. Specifically, the completion and successful lease-up of that large Liberty Towers renovation will remove a temporary drag on their same-store metrics and provide a clear mechanical boost to reported occupancy and NOI growth in future quarters. Easy comp coming up.
An internal catalyst,
exactly. And fourth, dividend growth. That conservative 50% FFO payout ratio provides significant capacity for future dividend increases once the balance sheet improves. This could attract income-oriented investors who might be on the sidelines now.
Okay, several potential triggers there. So on the flip side, just to reinforce, what are the primary concerns and risk factors that our listeners should really keep top of mind? Reinforcing that prove-it narrative we started with, what's the biggest hurdle they still face in completely winning over the market?
Right, the hurdles and risks remain significant.
Yep.
The biggest one is still the high financial leverage. That net debt-to-EBITDA ratio of 11.3x is the most significant challenge they need to overcome in the eyes of the market. It colors everything else. Then there's their geographic concentration in the New York City metropolitan area, which makes them inherently more susceptible to regional economic shifts or unforeseen localized events compared to more diversified peers. The execution risk on dispositions is also critical right now. Their deleveraging plan relies heavily on successful asset sales in what they admit is a challenging transaction market. Can they get the prices they need?
A big question mark.
And finally, the regulatory headwinds, particularly the threat or reality of rent control in their core markets, pose a long-term threat to revenue growth potential. So, yeah, it's a compelling story of transformation, but certainly not without its significant challenges and risks still ahead.
Understood. So, given everything we've unpacked today, the transformation, the assets, the operations, the debt, the valuation, the risks, what kind of investor might find Veris Residential appealing right now? And for whom might it just not be the right fit?
Yeah, Veris Residential's unique profile, really makes it suitable for specific investor types, while probably being less appropriate for others. For a value investor, it looks potentially highly attractive. That significant discount to net asset value provides a tangible margin of safety, on paper at least, and a clear path to value realization if management successfully executes its stated deleveraging plan. It fits a classic value mold.
Buying assets cheap.
Essentially, yes. Buying good assets wrapped in a levered company structure at a discount. For a growth at a reasonable price, GARP investor, the combination of strong, accelerating NOI and FFO growth, combined with a valuation that looks cheap on an asset basis, could be very compelling. This type of investor would be focused on the company's ability to sustain that operational momentum quarter after quarter. Prove the growth story. However, for an income-focused investor who is primarily seeking high current income, Pheris is probably less suitable right now. The dividend yield of approximately 2.2% is modest compared to many peers in the REIT space. While there's certainly strong potential for future dividend growth as the balance sheet improves, the current story for Pheris Residential is much more of a total return story, driven by potential capital appreciation as that valuation gap closes, rather than high current yield today.
So more for capital gains than current income?
Primarily, yes. It's a prove-it story, as we keep saying. But for those investors who believe in management's disciplined execution plan and the fundamental quality of their underlying assets, the opportunity to bridge that significant valuation gap is very real. But it requires execution.
Outro. Well, we've certainly given you a comprehensive look at Pheris Residential, Inc. today. We've traced its journey from a diversified, office-heavy past to its focused multifamily present. We've analyzed its market, its financials, its valuation disconnect, and its future potential. Now, hopefully, you're equipped with the insights to understand this complex situation far beyond just a simple headline or a stock ticker.
Yeah, and this raises, I think, an important final question for consideration. As Pheris Residential continues its journey of disciplined execution and deleveraging, will the market finally acknowledge the significant value that seems to have been created and re-rate the stock accordingly? Or will that credibility discount persist longer than expected, perhaps demanding, you know, a full economic cycle to play out in its new pure play model before full acceptance is granted? The next few quarters will certainly be very telling.
Exactly. A lot to watch. Our goal, as always, is to make you well-informed and hopefully provide those aha moments along the way. Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive.